Hello, and welcome to today's Talky Bit. It is good to be with you. Whenever I put these together for podcast, I have particular people in mind that I know join us only by podcast. And I want you to know, if you're listening to this, if you're a regular listener, how aware I am that you are part of this community, and how delighted I am that this particular milieu can be a helpful point of connection for you, and also how delighted I would be to meet you in person if that's never happened, or in the case many cases where it has happened, to see you again. And I look forward to any opportunity for that. Of course, if you're somebody who's dropping in for the first time to our podcast, welcome. You may wish to know, if this is the first encounter you've had with the community called The Table, that we do also gather in person in Winnipeg regularly, not so regularly for the last 2 years, but we're getting it back in gear, but also online. There's a Facebook group under The Table, Winnipeg, that you can join if you want to see some faces to go with the names and the voices, and if you want to meet musicians and be part of that part of our gathering and share in a community time in a way that's a little bit more interactive. But for now, welcome to today's Talky Bit, my podcast. It's good to have you here. Some of you might recall a few weeks ago I went on a bit of a Wendell Berry tear, with poems and everything. Just to preemptively head off any concerns, I'm not going to do that this week. Not because of any negative response. I think this is a community generally that has some capacity, interest, intrigue with that way of engaging with language and ideas. So no negative response, but I'm not going to do it this week just because I managed to tamp down my own impulse, you know, to do that. However, I do want to mention one teensy little stanza from one of those poems that keeps rattling around in my head and rattling around in my life and challenging me to see the world differently. And mostly that's the point sometimes, right? Just to see the world differently. So this is the second stanza from Wendell Berry's poem called How to Be a Poet, brackets to remind myself. Breathe with unconditioned breath, the unconditioned air. Shun electric wire. Communicate slowly. Live a three-dimensioned life. Stay away from screens. Stay away from anything that obscures the place it is in. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. In particular, for me these days, it's that idea of live a three-dimensioned life and staying away from anything that obscures the place that it is in that keeps coming back. And when something keeps coming back to me like that, keeps surfacing, when I'm not provoking it to surface, when I'm not seeking it out, those are things that I really try to pay attention to. And so I've been trying to pay some attention to this. In many ways, this little exploration we're launching into today, and it will have more than one part, but it will not have a zillion parts, is a product, if you will, an outcome of that attending. I love that Berry associates that call to living a three-dimensional life so directly with his conviction that there are no unsacred places, but that it all comes down to our seeing the world that way, as sacred, and choosing, as much as it's up to us, to not desecrate anything. Anything, because if everything is sacred, anything we desecrate is to desecrate the sacred. And under desecrate, Berry is including choosing anything that flattens reality over a direct encounter with it as lesser. He's saying, if this is not an outright desecration, what we're doing right now, all these screens and cameras and things, then from Berry's point of view, then it's certainly nudging against it. And that in itself, as a life idea, is enormously challenging in this age. I want to expand on that notion of a fully dimensioned life a bit today by applying that imagery to the world of religions. And I am deeply indebted in this regard, in the ideas that I'm unfolding here following, to the late Marcus Borg, and in particular to a collection of his essays and lectures. It's entitled Days of Awe and Wonder. At the Table, which is a community that exists to make a space where we can explore what we believe, the path of exploration certainly doesn't tend to be limited to the exploration of Christian beliefs and practices. The majority of us in this community have some roots in that tradition. Some of us still find it a vibrant one in our own lives and have chosen that religion as our path. Others of us have had the kind of experiences or encountered ways of thinking in the context of Christianity that make it kind of a non-starter, on magnitudes ranging from not very interesting to outright triggering and traumatic. And yet, we come together every week to explore what we believe. Judy, you talked about this in some of what you had to say in and amongst the songs that you shared with us this morning. Your story about having a conversation with a colleague that identified as Jewish and talked about going to synagogue and saying, you don't have to believe in God to go to synagogue. Well, and that being a bit of a surprise in light of your own personal history with religion, I understand that. I resonate with that. And I would also say that one of the great joys in my life is that this community, The Table, is a community where I know that not everyone in it believes in God. And I know that many people within it do not hold the Christian conception of God. And yet here we are, sharing together in this exploration, which often is not references one tradition over others as an entry point, if you will, or a something to measure against or push off from. I find that fascinating, and I know that it's a bit unusual. It was not very long ago in the dominant cultural contexts of this part of the world that this would have been pretty nearly unthinkable. And there are still lots of places where it is unthinkable. I, in my position at the table, I sometimes have occasion to hear from folks who find themselves feeling more at home in places where what we're doing is unimaginable than they would be feeling at ease here. I'm glad they have a place that feels good and right to them. I know it's not a place that I would feel the same way. And again, it just sort of illustrates this enormous cross-section of experiences that we have. When it comes to religion on this continent, as we approach the quarterway mark of the 21st century, the reality is that we live in a pluralistic society, culturally, ethnically, religiously pluralistic. And we might use a more general word for this in our everyday conversation, like diverse. We talk about cultural diversity. We talk about ethnic diversity, diversity of traditions and practices. And I think this is a really interesting time to be alive in this place. As we continue to learn and grow in our understanding of the implications of that reality, we're slowly, I believe this, I know there's lots of evidence to the contrary, but I choose to look to the positive indicators on this. I think that we are slowly figuring out that this isn't an occasion where a dominant culture or religion accommodates the other cultures and religions, but rather a much broader, more encompassing project in which many people who believe many different things, whose lenses on everything differ, are working at learning how to value one another as equals and figuring out how to live and work together in harmony. Some of us have lived with so much privilege that we are accustomed to doing what I just described from some sort of a vertical position. At least we perceive it that way. We are the dominant understanding, the dominant lens. Now we have to try to figure out how to get along with people whose lens is not just different, but lesser. Well, that different equals lesser, like that's the short path to a lot of things that we are increasingly seeing with clarity are dehumanizing, are diminishing, are wrong, are unjust. That's the short version of lots of destructive isms. If you are different than me, you are less than me. Not a good starting place. And we're starting to figure that out, I think. So these days, that's my operating assumption, that we live in a pluralistic setting, and that pluralistic setting is the wider context in which we, the table, and others as well, explore what we believe. That's the baseline. Now, if you are coming to this moment, this particular conversation, from a place of religious exclusivism, from a mindset that says our or my religion is the only true one and anyone who believes otherwise is lost in the dark, then what I'm about to explore is probably largely irrelevant to you. You don't need this, and you don't want this. This bag isn't for you. Don't pick it up. It'll probably just make you mad, And that anger might spill over onto others, which may well make it harder for you to behave in the ways that your religion says a good person in your religion should behave. And kind of a negative domino effect, because shame is often the cousin of that kind of an experience. And then when we feel ashamed, we don't tend to behave better. So I would say that if you just heard me say this and you're like, but I believe that my religion is the right and true way and all others are not, then I would say only stay if you're authentically curious. Know that the welcome is wide, but know that what I'm about to explore really might not feel like something that you're intrigued by. However, if you're with me so far, stick around. I think that where we're headed today can be profoundly hopeful and really beautiful for anyone that seeks a path for transformation, for having their explorations of belief lead to a spiritual center that can bring life closer to being more fully dimensioned, more 3D, if you will, more like what Wendell Berry was talking about in that stanza from his poem. So with that as our general context, let me kind of just get into some content here, some ideas about ways that we might look at religions in general with, I would say, both a bit more depth and a bit more clarity, including whatever religion we might know best or even identify with most personally or at present. First of all, maybe just an important kind of corollary question. Why focus on religions at all? Why spend time and energy on this? Why not just cut to the chase, as so many have done, of I'm spiritual but not religious, ditch all the religions, as per John Lennon's song Imagine, and get on with it? I mean, don't religions generally cause more problems than good? Looking back, that's not a hard argument to make. Wouldn't life be better off without them? Why do we need these structures and institutions and frameworks and doctrines and dogmas anyway? Some of what we're going to explore will address itself obliquely to those ideas. I'm not going to bring those particular ideas out into the center at this point and make them explicit, so you might have to watch for those intersections if they're important to you, but they are there. Here's my starting point. As a beginning place, I'm working with the idea that all religions are cultural, linguistic traditions. And what that means, to just break the term down a little bit, is that each religion originates within a particular culture, and as a result, it uses the language and the symbols of that culture. The fact that Christianity, for example, has as this central symbol a cross, we can make all sorts of religious things of that, of course, have done, will do. However, it was a cultural symbol. It was a cultural symbol of Roman imposition, of Roman domination and oppression and violence. It was a Roman torture device. That's pretty fascinating. And when we stand back from it a little bit, very important. So every religion has this as its part of its reality. It works with the language and the symbols of that culture. And beyond those origins, when a religion sticks around for a while, and all the major religions have done so, the religion becomes a cultural linguistic tradition of its own, on its own right. Now, another way to say that is that if a religion sticks around for a while, the religion becomes its own way of structuring the world. It starts to have its own language and its own symbols for doing so. The point at which a subculture becomes a culture, good luck teasing that one out. But you get a religion that has been around long enough and wielded enough power in terms of governance in the world, the way that, for example, Christianity has done in the Western world, and you start to understand the truth of this. Have a short conversation with anyone who studies film and who's thought about this as regards film, and they will probably be able to explain to you how most narratives are Christian narratives in their general shape, culturally speaking. There's this problem, it needs a solution, there's a conflict involved in trying to resolve the issue. Someone suffers, maybe someone dies, but you make some movement forward. If it's a happy ending story, there's a new version of something on the other side of that death. So this framework of death and resurrection, of dying and then something new coming from that death, that's a Christian cultural idea, but it shows up in all kinds of ways in Western thought and language. That's for instance. Maybe we don't think about this until we're outside of it, thinking about it. But if you've ever been in a setting where everyone seemed to know some kind of insider code that you don't know, then you've experienced what I'm talking about. And these days, personally, I can get that sensation just by texting some of the young adults in my life and wondering what the current of briefs and their reply mean. And yes, I do know I can look them up on the same internet where they were created. I do understand all of that. But that first moment, right, where you're looking at your screen and there's this string of letters on there that you are clearly expected to make meaning of, but what they look like is like the results of a game of Scrabble where somebody stole a bunch of the letters and still tried to make words. That's the moment that I'm talking about, all right? Also, personally, again, I've been away from most conventional or traditional Christian religious settings for enough years now that I can have this experience when I find myself someplace where people are tossing around religious jargon with the assumption that everyone in the room knows what it means. I mean, maybe I don't want to be washed in lamb's blood, you know? Try to hear that from the vantage point of it's not a meaningful symbol to me, and it's just weird and ugly. So that experience. It might be helpful to think of being from a particular religion or religious tradition as akin to being from a particular cultural tradition in general. So to be French, for example, means more than just knowing French. It means to have lived within a French world, to know something about the ethos of being French, of having that world, the French world, structure your vision of life. Religious traditions cover more ground than that in some ways because they can transcend national, racial, or ethnic boundaries. You could be a French Buddhist or a French Christian or a French Jew, or you know what I mean? So that is a little bigger funnel than that. But having said that, it can still be helpful to think of religions in general as cultural linguistic traditions with their own language and their own symbols and other identifiers. So that's sort of stop one. The second idea is one that we've talked about in this space before, not directly in relation to what we're exploring today, but in other ways. And that's the idea that religions are human constructions or human products, if you will. And you've often heard me say something in this space along the lines of religions are something we make, so let's see if we can make as good a one as we can if we're involved in religion making. That idea fits hand in glove with the previous one. If religions are cultural linguistic traditions, if they're working with the elements of culture and language, things that humans create, then they are human creations. Does that make sense? One of these does follow on the other. Now, this isn't just true of their outlines, sort of their big hegemonic ideas, but also of their contents, by which I mean their scriptures, their teachings, their doctrines, their rituals, their practices. Harvard religious scholar Gordon Kaufman talks about religions as, quote, imaginative human constructions, close quote. And he's not talking down to religions when he chooses that language. He's not using imaginative to mean something really way out there or meaninglessly fanciful. He means imaginative as both creative, in a sense of making something meaningful, and also as a task that uses the language of imagination. And imagination just means seeing what isn't there. Like that's sort of the short version of what it means, seeing what isn't physically there. And that's the language. When we're trying to do that, we use the language of images and the language of symbols and the language of story, those kinds of things. And so when Kaufman talks about making religion as an imaginative act, he's talking about a human act that uses things like images, symbols, and story. Now, this is one of those ideas that can be quite a, you know, my way or the highway sort of issue for folks. Within the three major Western religions, the Abrahamic traditions, as they're often called, there are lots of people that would say that their religion comes straight from God, that it's a divine and not a human product. In traditional Muslim teaching, the Quran was dictated by Allah to Muhammad. Within Judaism, Orthodox Jews would typically affirm that the Torah, both the laws given to Moses on Mount Sinai and the oral Torah, was given directly to Moses by God. Hand it over. And fundamentalist Christians typically claim that the Bible is a divine product and to be regarded as infallible and inerrant. So right there, we've got three major traditions, all claiming a divine product, curiously all sharing an origin story, but all claiming a divine product, the contents of which are not all in agreement, sometimes in rather obvious ways. So you can sort of see the problem brewing, right? Which is one reason why, for those that study these things comparatively, all of those claims look like pretty typical human behavior. which is the tendency of humans to ground a sacred tradition, their sacred tradition, in God. So to put it another way, lots of us humans, in the process of making religions, say, as part of that process, our tradition comes from God. So it's not some kind of massive reach to observe that a claim like divine origins is typical of religions in general. This is not unusual. We could say the same thing about particular elements within religions if we got kind of more into them. So, for example, the fact that Christianity has a Messiah story, not unusual. There are other religions that have Messiah stories. There were other people around during the same time period that Jesus was around that claimed to be the Messiah that fit with the story of Judaism about waiting for a Messiah, for example. So, again, not that unusual a thing within the context of religions. It's a characteristic of lots of religions to make those kinds of claims, not just the religion that the person making the claim happens to be from. Okay, one more idea for today, and then we're going to pick this up again next week. The first of those two statements, cultural linguistic traditions and the idea that that religions are human constructs, those two statements come down pretty heavily on the side of religion being an entirely human endeavor. And that can feel like it's observably true enough, as far as it goes. But for many of us, religious contexts and even religious structures have been the setting for some experiences that are hard to explain just on the basis of that framework alone. And even if we don't resonate personally with that when I say it, we may well know people that do. I think around our community, not that big a gathering of humans, and I can think of many people who would say, yeah, but I've had this experience or that experience, and, you know, it sure didn't feel like it stopped at the thing we humans made when we made a religion, right? So there's that. How do those first two observations, linguistic cultural traditions and human constructs, human products, how do those previous observations evolve or shift if we entertain the possibility that religions, their very existence, the fact that there are religions, is a response, a human response, to the experience of the sacred? And as a baseline for sacred, again, I would go back to Wendell Berry's idea that everything is sacred. We might use other words for sacred. Especially in religious settings, we might use a word like spirit, we might use a word like God, we might use a word like love. Increasingly in the 21st century West, we use the language of universe. William James, early 1900s, very original American thinker. James worked in and between the disciplines of physiology, psychology, and philosophy. When James talked about this in his still intriguing and relevant work called The Varieties of Human Experience, he used the word more for this realm. James can be a little bit hard to pin down if you want to sort of go, what does he believe? What's his position, if you will? But he was certainly, among other things, a pragmatist. In fact, the title of his last and some would say most influential work was Pragmatism. But he also had a deep abiding commitment to the notion that there is, and these are sort of his words for this idea, there is one fundamental stuff. Simple words for big things like more and stuff. There is one fundamental stuff that is neither material nor mental. That all humans experience what they experience in the context of some fundamental stuff that is neither material nor mental. In other words, he was suggesting that there is a more that is neither fully accessible by measuring or observing the material world, maybe we would say the world of the hard sciences, nor accounted for by saying it's all in your head, by what happens inside of our brains, if you will. Maybe we could say the worlds of psychology, philosophy, and theology, the realm of thoughts and ideas, notions. And in some ways, what James called more is what I'm calling the sacred. Here's the idea that I'll leave us to muse about a bit more as we head into our week. What happens to how we think about religions including whatever one or ones we grew up around, if we grew up around a religion at all. And increasingly, I know more and more people who didn't, personally. But what happens if we think about religions, whether we were close to them or not, as the things that humans have created in response to their encounters with more, or if you prefer, with the sacred? They have, these things we make in response to those encounters, they have the characteristics of the culture in which they were made, because that's the context in which those that made them also encountered a more that called out for both an explanation and a way of approach or access. Some of us have encountered more in ways that were distressing. We wouldn't want to go back there. But that's not the usual story. Generally speaking, when we have a spiritual experience, it is, and Judy, you used this word and explored these ideas a little bit again in the front part of our gathering together. We might use the word transcendent, right? So it's something that rises above our everyday, accessible by the material or idea kind of human experiences. What if we think about the things that we make out of those experiences, often as not religions, as ways of understanding those things or explaining them and reapproaching them, coming to them again and accessing them on purpose? To use a different image, what happens to our thinking about religions if we think about them as on-ramps? They are not the freeway. They're an on-ramp. Now, imagine a particular religion as an on-ramp rather than the on-ramp. Still not the freeway, but also not the only way to access the freeway. And sometimes things happen in life that mean the on-ramp we're most familiar with, the route we've always used, stops working. Last week, if you lived where I live in East St. Paul, Henderson Highway flooded right by the perimeter, and those of us who live in East St. Paul had to take a detour. We could still get to the freeway, to the perimeter, in this case in Winnipeg, but we couldn't get there the way we used to because the exit that we were used to using went under, and we had to look for another way. Something happened beyond our control, what insurance companies curiously call acts of God, and we had to find another way to get where we were going. The freeway was still there. We could see it from the very place we were blocked from it. But we had to find a different on-ramp. All right. That's where I'm going to leave us today, standing in the middle of a flooded highway, wondering how we can get to the place that we can tell is there, but knowing that the way that we used to go won't work. That's where I'm going to leave us. And I would say that if I think about that and kind of go, well, what are the implications of that? I would say that the core implication is that it's time to go exploring. That it's time to look around and see what the alternatives might be. So that's where we're going to pick this up next week. And we're going to pick it up with some further consideration of what many, even most religions have in common, which I think can help inform our imaginations about the more, if you will, and the human experience of the more, and what sort of different things get made out of that commonality, because religions are, as we've already touched on, and as we've often experienced personally, can be very, very different from one another. All right. If you were joining us today by podcast, thanks for being with us. It's been good to be with you. If you were joining in the live stream, it's been good to be with you. And I look forward to our next occasion to be together. Peace, everybody. Do take care. Continue to seek a three-dimensioned life, a life in which the things that flatten the place that they are in are minimized and direct encounter with reality is maximized, including the other humans in the place. All right. Bye for now.